This entire season of Retronauts is fully funded by listeners like you thanks to Patreon. If you'd like to find out how you can help and get episodes a week in advance, head on over to patreon.com/retronauts. Thanks and enjoy the show. This week on Retronauts.
Hi, mister! Wanna play with me?
Hello, everybody. We are back. This is Volume 4 of Retronauts, Episode 28 of our new season. I guess we're just continuing where we left off, so welcome back, everybody. And today's topic is gaming's greatest flops. And before I go on any further, by the way, my name is Bob Mackey, the host. I should have said that earlier. Before I go on any further, let's introduce who else is here today. Who is to my left?
Ray Barnhold.
Ray's back.
See, I told you.
For this podcast,
yeah, right? I'd still be around.
Cool. How you doing, Ray?
I'm fine, thank you.
And who else is returning for Retronauts Volume 4?
Oh, that's me, Jeremy Parrish, sitting in the same room as everyone else.
For once.
Smelling everyone. It's delightful.
Yeah, it's a record 72 degrees here in SF today, so it's going to be kind of hot and steamy.
A little balmy, a little sticky.
And who else is here today?
This is Brett Elston, and I'm mostly to blame for the current smell problem.
Come on, Brett. Get together. Mm. We like Brett. We're glad he's back. He was here for the, I think, the fan translation episode and the Friday the 13th Jaws one. And those were lots of fun. I love those episodes.
I never thought we'd have so much to say about Jaws for the NES.
That went on for a while, but I think there's still more to talk about.
Yeah.
We'll return to it one day. But yes, this is our new season. You probably heard a small bumper about our Patreon campaign, and I urge you to check it out because we are now fully fan-supported, and we are now on US Gamer. I think it's safe to say that unless something horrible happens between the time we record this and the time that it goes up.
Even if all of us get fired, or both of us get fired, I think they'll still try to get some advertising on Retronauts. It's probably worth mentioning that US Gamer is not actually giving us money.
True.
We're not being funded by US Gamer. It's just kind of like, we can cross-link. It's cool. Because you guys work here, so it makes sense. Mm. It's just a matter of pragmatism, really.
Yeah. We both have audiences with similar interests, I think. And
probably because we've sort of maybe unwisely cultivated a retro-focused audience on US Gamer.
Mm-hmm. I think we've been incredibly selfish by writing about things that only personally entertain us. But maybe that's not entirely
true. That's what makes the site fun.
Yeah. You could tell we're having fun doing it.
The Metroidvania month they did was probably a bad idea in hindsight.
Now this has turned too confessional. Anyway, please go to US Gamer and give to our Patreon. Keep subscribing to Retronauts. We're back. We're going to be around for a while, and we're going to be bi-weekly, correct? Or bi-monthly. They mean the same thing.
Semi-monthly.
Semi-monthly. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Bi-weekly is more accurate because it's every 2 weeks, whereas some months it could be three if it's one of those weird months with five Mondays in it.
That's a better way to put it. I know when I was writing resumes, there was no difference between bi-monthly and bi-weekly, so I had no idea what to put for things that I did once every 2 weeks.
Yeah.
So
rest assured, this podcast is Gregorian.
We are now following.
We are now chanting.
The Breatharian calendar, and I'll reveal more about that later after I tell you about my religious conversion. But let's go on to our topic today, which is gaming's greatest flops. And I think we talked a lot about systems that failed, but not nearly enough about games that failed. So this is a great chance to do that. And this is actually based on
a series. And piss a lot of people off.
Yeah, we're going to make you guys so mad. We're going to just pee all over the things you like.
Yeah.
But I did a series of articles for US Gamer about gaming's greatest flops, and most of the material that I covered in this one is going to be covered in our podcast, but I think we have the addition of more voices, so you're not just going to be hearing the same things I wrote about, and I'm sure we can all bring different stuff to the table. But before I continue, I want to define flop because some of you out there might be like, hey, wait a minute, that game sold, it made a profit, it's not a flop. Well, for me, flop is kind of like a spiritual or philosophical thing. Like I said, some of these games sold well, but a flop in this case indicates like a catastrophic production or misguided creative figure at the head of this game, inflated egos, lack of experience, etc. Something that made the production of the game kind of more interesting than the game itself. You might disagree with that, but that's kind of what I wrote about with this series was what are the circumstances behind this game, these games that failed, and how did they end up being these huge disasters? And before I let you guys talk, I want to take over for one more second. And there are three signs I noticed in these flops that were common between all of the flop games. So the flop games have all these things in common. So you first have an overly ambitious scope. and or several sequels planned in the future. Like, it's not odd for a trilogy to come into being as like EA's kind of bring out this next trilogy or whatever. But like some of these games had like six chapter thing. Some of these games had an 11 chapter thing in the works. So they start with this huge scope before they can even prove themselves. So that's the one main important thing about what makes these games flops. Another thing is development always jumps from platform to platform. They end up taking so long they have to scrap what they did and move development to a new platform, which can cost millions and millions of dollars and years of work, as we'll see with some of these games. And usually there is a prickly and or enigmatic, although those aren't mutually exclusive, visionary who's acting as the engine for this game. So at the source of most of these games, you're going to see one controversial figure who is sort of like, this is their passion project, and this passion project is going to ruin lives and rob people years of their livelihood. So this is going to be a very positive episode to start with.
Game development.
Yeah, it's just like it never got better for anybody. But so yeah, like I said, please check out the series on US Gamer, usgamer.net. You can just search for it. I'm sure if you search for gaming's greatest flops, it'll turn up too. But I'm really proud of these articles, and I really love this subject, which is why I'm doing it for the podcast. Any thoughts on flops before I start here? Just are you guys clear on what the definition is, and like do you agree, do you disagree, anything? Mm-hmm. Was I pretty concise?
It did make me think. I don't know if this will come into play later in the show or not, so apologies if I'm spoiling or ruining anything. But do you feel this is a more modern phenomenon? Like, I can't really think of something that would fit the bill like pre-PS2 almost.
Yeah, I think it really – a lot of these games are confined to one era, and that is like the late 90s, early 2000s. One, because there was a lot of money to be thrown around, which we'll get into. Another thing was technology was advancing so quickly that people did not know how to make games for this new hardware. They did not know how to make games that were of this bigger scope. So I think that was the major failing we'll see. Mm-hmm. But you're right. I don't think there were as many flops just because of the simple fact that games were not as expensive to make. Can you think of anything?
I think that's a big part of it, is that there were lots and lots of games that, you know, aimed big and still fell flat before PS2, obviously, back in the 80s. Yeah. But, you know, aiming big back then was pretty small potatoes compared to what we have now. We're talking like a budget of $1 million, if that, compared to budgets of hundreds of millions.
Right. And excuse me, we're going to see games like that lose less money than games lose today. Like, oh my God, this game costs $40 million. Well, you know, look at GTA's budget or something like that, and it's well into the hundreds of millions. Or
I believe that's a quarter of a billion.
Quarter of a billion. Okay. And I know this was thrown around, but Destiny recently came out, and that had like a $500 million budget, including marketing. I don't know what they were doing, like breaking diamonds with hammers, I guess, one day, and they were bored.
It was a great commercial.
Yeah. I'll go down in history as it's like, wow, they wasted a lot of money. But yeah, like these are going to be much simpler times when you hear about how little money in retrospect was lost. But at the time, no one assumed a game could lose that much money. No one assumed a game could cost that much to make. But now we're in the era of like, oh, your game better have a 3-figure budget if you're a Tomb Raider, if you're an Uncharted, if you're a The Last of Us. So, yeah.
It kind of seems like the movie equivalent. It always reminds me of Waterworld. Had this reputation forever of like, oh, the biggest flop, the most expensive, misdirected, whatever. But then like it still ended up making money in the long run.
Right.
So it's like in the grand scheme, it's not the biggest flop. But like in your soul, you're like, man, what a mess.
Right. It's forever attached to, you know, all the stories you've heard about it. Another hurricane knocked down the newest set they built. And now we're going to ship that over to SeaWorld or whatever. I don't know. So yeah, let's move on to our first game we're talking about today, which will be Shenmue. So Shenmue came from the mind of Yu Suzuki, who basically was Sega's arcade game maker for, God, I don't know, 15 years, possibly longer. I mean, like, he started with things like Hang-On, Outrun, Space Harrier.
He was the innovator.
Yeah, definitely. And then he went on to do stuff like Virtua Fighter, the first things in 3D. Like, he, from the very beginning, was trying to approximate 3D gaming, and then he eventually did it with things like Virtua Fighter. Was he doing Virtua Racer? Ray, or was that somebody else? Okay, man, he did everything for Sega. Sure. Unfortunately, Sega, you know, the arcade business was dying, and he couldn't be as productive in the arcade business as he could, so he had a new idea for a new huge project, which would be the culmination of all of his ideas to date, I guess, because it kind of you know, incorporates all the things he's worked on before, except, I guess, you know, floating through space,
right,
through checkerboard patterns or whatever.
It's his great Japanese novel.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, I like that, Ray. Yeah. So this was going to be a Virtua Fighter RPG. That's what it started life as, on the Saturn. So the Saturn needed a killer app, and I guess this was going to be it. And if you look at the Saturn footage, it looks really impressive. And I'm sure it's on YouTube. I forget if it leaked officially or not.
No, it was on, Shenmue 2.
Oh, Shenmue 2.
It was like a bonus or something, yes.
And if you
Shenmue?
If you look at the graphics on display, you're like, how did this happen? The Saturn can't do 3D. Like, it could barely, like, render polygons, and they're making this nearly photorealistic, you know, in retrospect, not really, but it was
probably
so close.
Probably a RAM cartridge, like the size of a table.
Yeah. It's like, it does work on kerosene, so watch out for that. So, yeah, it started life as a Saturn game, was going to be a Virtua Fighter RPG, and it eventually stopped doing that because the Saturn was effectively dead, didn't live very long, neither did the Dreamcast, but they didn't know that, not yet at least. Mm-hmm. And this game would be like a new genre. So in the tradition of Japanese developers making their own genres, making their own systems, uh-huh, giving them convoluted names, this would be FREE, Full Reactive Eyes Entertainment, and that basically meant this was an open world game because we didn't know what an open world game was. They didn't know what it was either. They just knew this thing was possible now, and they were going to figure it out as they went along. And that's kind of where the problems began. I want to ask you guys, where did you follow Shenmue's development? Did you follow it through magazines? I mean, it was always being hyped as like this, like the next big game. Like,
I mean, I read Next Gen magazine religiously at the time. So, of course, that's all they could talk about.
Right. I remember when it was Project Berkeley. Yeah. They announced it like that.
Oh, right, right.
Yeah.
Reading, and I think through Next Gen and other magazines at the time, it just, as someone who was still like, I want more games like Symphony of the Night, all these polygons, wah, wah, wah. And then when the idea of Shenmue, it almost seemed like too big. I remember reading about it and just thinking like, I can't even figure out how you play this.
Right,
like,
right.
Like, it wasn't in front of me to play, but like reading the articles and interviews, I was just like, so what do? You walk around Japan? I don't, what? Who's the boss? Like,
it did have a very singular focus and a very singular audience in mind, and we'll get to that soon because that's sort of why it failed. But I had the same opinion too. Like, I guess I didn't realize it until I played Grand Theft Auto 3. But you know, the idea of walking into every house is kind of boring. Like, I mean, that was sort of where technology had misled our brains into thinking that would be interesting.
Yeah.
Like, you're going to go online to buy something. You're going to walk through a virtual store. I think I brought this up on an All Retronauts. You're going to, like, stand in a virtual line. Like, simulating boring shit was an important thing to people at this time. That's why The Sims came out. I mean, The Sims was a much better game than Shenmue, in my opinion. But we were very fixated on recreating, like, mundanity with 3D graphics.
Yeah, I mean, you look at Ultima Online, and, like, that was really kind of a, like, go farm and go chop wood kind of simulator. There wasn't nearly as much combat in that as you would expect from an Ultima game. And I think that sort of, like, if we're going to be realistic and we're really going to, you know, simulate life, we need to emulate all the parts of life, including the ones that you always forget about because they're so tedious.
Yeah.
What does the hero do when he's not on a quest?
How come no one in Star Trek movies ever has to go to the bathroom?
Yeah. I was just going to bring up Jack Bauer, but thank you. So, yeah, like, no one knew what an open world game was. I'm sure there were stabs at it that I can't think of right now, but no one had really made anything like that in 3D before. Am I missing anything? I mean, I feel like
The only thing I can think of, not quite the same, is Body Harvest.
Yeah, that's true.
And, you know, if you want just kind of like an open world, roam around sort of aimless game, there was Tale of the Sun for PlayStation. But, I mean, the world that created was just kind of this pretty stark, empty, open field, not a lot of navigation points, as opposed to Shenmue, which was trying to accurately model real world environment in exacting detail.
Right.
Tale of the Sun was about a lack of civilization.
Yeah.
Yeah, just creating a city you could walk through was important to people at the time. Just creating, like, just a recreation of life was what people were looking for. And
I remember, you know, kind of freaking out at SimCopter because you could make SimCity 2000
levels.
Oh,
I love SimCopter. Yeah, that's right.
They converted them into 3D and then you could explore then.
Yeah. And all the men you picked up kissed each other because that was a fun prank. Look it up, kids. It was a weird hack someone did.
Yeah.
So let's keep going. So, okay, Shenmue gets delayed a bunch because we're going to get into why, but there's a lot of work going into things no one cares about, which is why development stretched on for so long. So Sega releases a bonus disc called What's Shenmue? And that is released to people who pre-ordered the game in Japan, and it is sort of like a tongue-in-cheek. Sega got really
Punchy.
I think they got really into making fun of themselves too towards the end.
Because the there was Segata Sanshiro.
Sega Gaga, whatever. Like, that was all about making fun of themselves. And so this What's Shenmue thing had a bit in it where Ryo, who is a protagonist, he runs into the Sega head managing director's office, and he's just sitting at his desk with his head in his hands, surrounded by unsold Dreamcast. And you get the sense that,
it's based on an ad campaign.
Oh, really? It is? Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I didn't know that. But, I mean, like, the fact that they were able to go that far, and I think they knew there was no pulling out of this. I don't think they thought this game was going to save them. They were just in so far they had to finish this game and get it out. But I think that was, like, a sign that, yeah, like, this could be it for us. Like, and I feel like Shenmue was very much engineered to be their swan song, even if it wasn't that successful, either critically or financially for them. So, as I said before, these horrible projects that go out of all off kilter, they end up, they start with the scope way too big. They start with the focus on world building when these worlds haven't even proved themselves to be interesting yet. So Shenmue started with 11 chapters. So Yu Suzuki sat down and was like, this is going to be 11 chapters. Chapter 1 is a Dreamcast game, and the next one will be a Dreamcast game. I'm not sure if he planned for this series to span future consoles. I guess he assumed that these games would be easier to make as long as one was finished. They could keep working on more. I don't know, Ray, what do you
I don't know, but like there are like there's more than one example of the Dreamcast game that's episodic.
Yeah.
So I don't know if that was really the
plan. But the thing is, El Dorado's Gate is nowhere near as huge as Shenmue. I mean,
for some reason people were doing it the most on Dreamcast. There was that, and there was like some visual novels as well.
Yeah, but I mean, those were like tiny bite-sized games as opposed to Shenmue, which was the biggest thing ever.
Yeah,
Titanic of video games.
Well, I think even Suzuki didn't even really know, because like it was very quickly after it was released. It was like, oh yeah, Shenmue 2 will be these chapters. More than one in one.
And that was kind of a thing in the 90s in Japan. You had, the Ogre Battle Saga, which presented itself as like, this is chapter 5 of the Ogre Battle Saga. And then there was Xenosaga
as well.
Well, Xenosaga was later. That was after Shenmue. But Xenogears, at the very end, it's like episode 5 of the Xenogears saga or whatever.
Yeah, but you can tell they're bullshitting there.
Yeah.
But when you look at what
I think in their hearts they weren't bullshitting. They were like, we are going to make so many of these Xenogears games. It's going to be amazing. And then, that's what Xenosaga was them trying to refine it into 6 chapters. Yeah. Oh, wait, I mean 3.
Yeah. Why are we talking about that instead?
Oh, that's right. We can talk about it after the main games, though.
Yeah. We can talk about it when Xenosaga HD comes out.
That's not going to happen, is it? Is that real? Oh, no, Jeremy. I mean, this can't be real, right?
At the time of this recording, there's been like talk by who was it? Takahashi? Harada? Harada, yeah. About actually remastering the Xenosaga games in HD. But basically what he said was, I don't think that's going to happen.
It's like, we impressed you with Xenoblade. Get ready to hate us all over again.
Please stop signing a petition 10 times apiece, because that doesn't help us.
Okay. Let's move on. We're still talking about Shenmue. So we're talking about the chapters in this game. And at least from my research that I read, he planned on each game to be a chapter. So in this first chapter, nothing happens. They're establishing the story. They're establishing his quest. They're establishing where he has to go. But all this game is about is finding a boat, like finding a way. Like, which way did he go? He went that way. It's just a series of he went that way until you find the way he went and then take a boat there. Essentially, that's all this game is about.
Which is actually kind of similar to Final Fantasy VII, where you're just like following Sephiroth around. Except Final Fantasy VII had a completely kick-ass bang-up opening that got everyone pulled in. If Shenmue had started with like,
that cool cinema scene of
But I mean, like, it's not interactive. It's like Final Fantasy VII. You've got like 30 minutes of cool, like, wow, I'm in the middle of the game, and then it slows down and lets you kind of build up to the story.
Yeah, and in Shenmue, you wake up and your mom gives you allowance, and you're like in your 20s. So.
Like Shenmue, to this day, my Dreamcast, the VMU says I played the game for 11 minutes.
Wow.
And it was me waking up, opening the door. Cool, there's a Saturn in this drawer. Walk outside, pet a cat. Every single door in the vicinity, perhaps they're out. I don't get it. Turned it off. I've never played it since that day.
I had a similar – I guess we can talk about our personal experiences and spread I was sharing. Like and I know we probably have a lot of people who love this game, but I really don't. I mean, like, I can respect what it does. I had fun with it. I never finished it. But a lot of it is not appealing to me because I think it was meant to speak to a generation of Japanese people who grew up in this time, in this era.
Yeah.
And the fact that they made such a high-budget game that only could basically appeal to people on this island, you know, on the planet. Grand Theft Auto was successful because, like, everyone has the mob or mob movies as a touchstone, even if you're not from America. But this was such a specific time in Japan that very few members of its audience outside of Japan were understood. But for people who are playing this, like, oh, that was 15 years ago. Like, I remember all this stuff.
Actually, but depending on when this episode airs, it'll be 15 years almost exactly to the launch date.
Oh, wow.
So we're talking – so it was kind of like the Super 8 of of video games, except Japanese-focused and also not very accessible.
Okay. Super 8 was that movie?
Yeah, the like, very obvious Steven Spielberg 80s homage by J.J. Abrams.
It's about growing up in the 80s in America with monsters.
No, yeah. I mean, it's it's very, like, a Steven Spielberg pastiche, but it really captures that, like, 1983 movie feel to it.
I like it. I need to see that, actually.
Yeah, I enjoyed it.
Jeremy, did you play Shenmue?
No. You know, the thing is, I have never played Shenmue. The game did not – like, I followed it. It did not resonate with me at all, but I was still fascinated by it. I bought the game, but I just never got to the point – like, you can't accuse me of causing the game's death, okay? Yeah. I helped. I tried to make it profitable, but there was just something about it. Like, I just never felt motivated to try it out, and I would like to play it now. Because I've discovered, oh, I like kind of aimless open world games. I mean, my 150 hours in Skyrim have nothing to do whatsoever with the plot line. And now that I've been to Japan quite a few times, I could, you know, definitely grasp more of what's happening and the sort of environment and culture. But in, you know, 1999, 2000, I hadn't been to Japan yet. Mm. I didn't really know what an open world game was. I still was still, you know, kind of struggling to find what it was about Sega that I admired. So, yeah, it was like this great game in theory that just never, ever connected with me. So it'd be nice if someone did an HD remake of it and maybe tightened it up a little bit and brought it to current platforms or something, which is probably never going to happen, but it would be interesting. I would definitely give it a try this time.
Yeah, I would like to see how a modern audience would react to it now that, I guess, indie games have made this kind of non-game more palatable. Not that I'm not going to get into that whole can of worms, but you know what I mean. The traditional game. I think
right, like
I
Gone
think,
Home.
Yeah,
stuff.
I think Gone Home's a game, but it's not a game that you normally play. You know, but Shenmue is very much the same sort of thing as Gone Home, where it's like you're observing details in the world around you. Although Gone Home does a better job of like getting you to where you need to be instead of just meandering. Ray, did you play Shenmue?
Yeah, it sounds like I'm the only one that did.
Okay, I might have played it longer than Brett and Jeremy, but only a few hours. And I did buy it when it came out. I paid full price for it.
No, so
you're welcome, you Suzuki.
I finished both. Although originally I didn't like the first one that much. I didn't really get it, and the control was really awkward. So I came back to it like a couple years later, and then I finally finished it. And I appreciated it a bit more, and I'm not saying I love it, but I found, you know, more comfort in the fact that it's just another adventure game. I mean, there's nothing special about it being a free FREE or anything like that. It's not as ambitious as everybody made it out to be. It's just a regular adventure game.
Yeah.
And I think once you get into that, it's like it's not as bad because you just have to find out, you know, here's some clues. Go find the clues. Go trigger the next plot points. Fight a boss every, I guess, 10 hours. But you know, and just try and leave Japan by December in the game. So, you know, I was not quite as hating it voraciously as some people did, and but I wouldn't really give it, you know, a high score either.
Well, one of the reasons it didn't go over well in America.
It is great for making fun of.
It is. It's really
all
good.
All the things that people make fun of.
And I'm going to get to that.
Totally great, yeah.
One of the greatest things to make fun of, and I'm going to drop all kinds of these within the episode itself, is the terrible localization.
Do you have a minute?
No. Talk to me later. If I get caught loafing on the job, the monk here really gets mad. I don't want to listen to his lectures.
All right. Sorry about that. Can you help me?
I don't know.
I understand. Can I ask you something?
I don't know.
Oh, okay.
Hello, welcome. There aren't many places more honest than us.
Thank you, but I accept no returns.
Oh, okay.
And you can read a brief interview with this about this with Jeremy Blaustein on Hardcore Gaming 101. But he essentially said that, like, normally not enough money is a problem with localization. But in this case, there was too much money. Money was just being thrown at everything. So people were not weighing their decisions very well. They were just, like, throwing money at everything. And Suzuki did not speak English, but he was in control of the English voice casting. Mm. So he wanted people who looked like their characters because he wanted them to do media events in Japan where you can meet the voice actors. And this happens a lot in Japan. Like, you'll see, like, a lot of publicity events of, like, voice actors sitting at, like, a table with their hands folded and people, like, bringing them things to sign. It's just a thing, for a way for people to promote things in Japan because it's a much smaller country. You can do public appearances like that, you know?
Right, and all that idolatry of, you know, voice actors and things. Mm. And so it all ties into that.
Yeah.
It is hilarious. So, because Yu Suzuki loved the English voices, you know, despite not understanding them at all. I think it's sort of the same thing I think as Kojima in Metal Gear, but he loved them so much that he made Shenmue the movie, which took all the cutscenes of the game basically, and it was only in English, but he released it. It was like a limited theater release in Japan, sort of like an indie movie sort of thing.
I can't believe that. But
if you bought Shenmue 2 here on Xbox, they included the DVD just in case you missed Shenmue 1, so you got to watch that as well.
I think that should be a Riff Trax or something. Wow. Somebody needs to take that on.
Yeah.
So. Yeah, I mean, like...
But it was all... That was... The Shenmue the movie was predicated only on Yu Suzuki just loving the English voices so much.
Mm-hmm. And perhaps...
how great and dramatic that was for him.
Perhaps if he became fluent in English, he would realize what poor decisions he made, because the main voice... I mean, all the voice acting is pretty bad. People either sound like they're on, like, Thorazine, or they've been lobotomized or something like that. But the main character, I forget who did his voice, but he had never acted before, and I don't think he's acted since. Mm. He was, like, a stunt guy or, like, a judo guy or something like that who could actually do the moves and, I guess, maybe help with motion capture and stuff like that. But
he was gaming's Jake Lloyd.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, yeah. I mean, like, he sounds like he's coming down off of Ambien in all of his scenes.
The same year, even.
Yeah. Wow. Maybe it was Jake Lloyd in a man suit. But
so,
yeah,
he
like...
He sits down at the hot hang-on machine. No, this is pod racing.
But yeah, like, the voice acting, like, okay... Yu Suzuki wants to communicate how important this story is, how you're going to follow it through all its 12 chapters. You turn it on, the voice acting is worse than, like, a Gamera movie dub from the 60s. Like, it is bad. It is rough. It is, like, Metal Gear Solid, the localization for that came out a year before. We were like, whoa, games can sound really good. I mean, it's still cheesy and James Bondish, but it's supposed to be. But a year later, Shenmue was like, oh, you are, like, it's like a CD-ROM game from 1992 or something. Yeah. It's just, like, you didn't know what was going on there. And I guess before we get final thoughts on Shenmue, it only lost $47 million. That was the budget, at least. I'm not sure how much of that it made back. And that does not seem like a lot in 2014. I assume it made back at least like half of that, probably, just based on hype alone. But
yeah.
Yu Suzuki didn't lose that much money for Sega, but he was still sort of like unofficially blacklisted, I guess.
I'm sure it's probably compounded with everything else that Sega was going through at the time.
True, true. Yeah, so I mean,
the Dreamcast itself was losing money, so it probably didn't help.
I'm sure that $47 million was important to Sega, and yeah. I'm sure they gave it to him because it did feel like this was their last hurrah. Like, he's been with us forever. He's done all of our best games. Let's give him a chance to do something no one's ever done before on a console. And this was still a time when you can do something that no one had ever done before in, like, the AAA space. I think it was much more welcoming to these weird and new ideas.
In theory, but, I mean, how well did Shenmue do?
Exactly, exactly. But, I mean, like, the chance was there until these things started losing tons of money. So any final thoughts on Shenmue? Like I said, I did not enjoy it as a game. I enjoyed it as an insane concept that existed in this tiny window of time where we were just fascinated with, you know, recreating the mundane aspects in life, yeah. Like petting cats, collecting toys, going through drawers, things like that.
Do you think it's Shenmue's fault that AAA games are so conservative and terrified of new ideas now?
I think we all forgot about this. I think we all forgot about Shenmue as soon as it happened. I think it took another generation for us to learn that because...
But, I mean, everybody compares the Yakuza games to Shenmue.
That's true,
and
yeah.
And those are pretty ambitious, and those are going on, you know, 6 or 7, 8 games strong now.
That is true. Thanks for bringing that up, Ray, because I feel like, okay, so when Sega brought over Yakuza... 6 years later, they spent time in the localization. They got stars, I put that in quotes, because yes, it was like Michael Madsen, Rachel Lee Cook or whatever, but they were still people that you would know. And they took time with the localization. I mean, they were not just getting people, you know, off the streets of Japan to come in and read these voices, these lines out of context. They were very careful to make this palatable to an English audience. Unfortunately, it didn't work that well. The rest were just subtitled, but still, they tried until they realized, like, hey, maybe people buying a game about Japan would want to hear Japanese. You know, maybe that would be just a thing that could happen. So,
yeah. A game about Japan needs more to it in the way that, you know, a Yakuza drama does than, you know, kid and his adventures in mundane vengeance.
Yeah, yeah. And I think like Yakuza has continued the tradition by being much more of a game, by being more gamey. Yeah. It's like an action RPG. I've enjoyed a few of them. I think you can't play all of them. You will get really bored and fatigued. But
and going to many different places.
Yeah, yeah.
And Shenmue Overwood. Like, oh, it's medieval Shenmue and now it's zombie Shenmue, you know?
And also it has all the same wealth of options that Shenmue did. Like you can play golf, you can play in the arcade, you can do karaoke, you can do all these things. So I feel like Yakuza is like the more refined Shenmue or the more, I guess, conservatively made where they're leading you down a path. It's not just like look at everything and try to have fun.
I mean, that's you know, just part of the hazards of innovating is that you're throwing stuff at the wall to see what sticks. And maybe it works out and maybe it doesn't. And you kind of have to make your mistakes before other people can or, you know, you can come in and say, oh, that's what I should have done. It's just that this happened to be a $50 million mistake.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, at a time when Sega could not afford to lose that kind of money or any money. It was the wrong time for that game for that company.
Speaking of your point earlier, like did this game set some precedent of everyone not wanting to take a chance? Like maybe not for Western devs, but maybe in Japan it did, because I think if you look at Japanese games post 2000, there does seem to be a lot of like, someone else going to make the next big innovation, crazy thing?
That is true.
Like,
yeah.
I'm waiting for it, and I'm totally going to refine it when you do it.
You do it, yeah. This is not related to gaming, but Sakaguchi, Final Fantasy dude, like right around this time I mentioned in my article, he did The Spirits Within, like, and that failed miserably too. Just like playing with technology, playing with too much money, I think maybe that did instill a fear in Japanese developers. Right. Like, these guys were like the guys to follow in our industry. And now no one can talk to them anymore because they lost too much money. We don't want to be like them. So and I think you could be right.
You know, I think also you have to look at Japanese, you know, kind of modern day post-World War II history to understand some of this too, because the 80s and the early 90s were the bubble economy over there. And they, like, people just threw money around and it didn't matter because everything was making money and people just had tons and tons of disposable cash. And when you look at something like Shenmue or The Spirits Within, it's very much that bubble mentality, but after the bubble had burst. And I think, you know, people who kind of made their names and made their fortunes in that very happy time were slow to adjust to the fact that they couldn't do that anymore. And, you know, of course, because of just the way seniority and clout works over there, no one could really say, you can't do that. So I think they had to make a couple of really expensive mistakes before the system could start to readjust to the new reality.
And currently Shenmue 3 is on permanent hiatus. I think there was an online game. Is that correct?
No, that was canceled.
That was canceled. Was there like a social network game,
I think? There was a phone game. Yeah.
Phone game. So I guess you can continue Ryo's adventures of...
I think he shows up in racing games sometimes.
True, on a forklift.
Yeah.
So, I feel like they're at least more willing to talk about Shenmue, where in the past they might not have wanted to bring up Ryo, they might not have wanted to put him in a racing game, things like that. I think they're okay with acknowledging this now, like it's been long enough, but there's still a lot of pain there. And I think Yu Suzuki is just coming out of hiding recently,
Yeah, he was at GDC this year.
Yeah, cool.
Talking about it would be great to crowdsource a Shenmue game, guys, please.
So life does go on. So our next game was actually really easy to do research on because this happened within the past few years. It's been recorded on podcasts, reported endlessly. It is kind of hard to find old news on games because nothing on the internet is preserved ever. So you're just like staring at remnants of like broken HTML, trying to pull out what's a quote, what's not a quote. But in this case, it was all there for me, and this was like the easiest one to do. But this is too human for the Xbox 360.
You could probably still find that Gap thread and just soak in it.
You know what? I tried, and it was closed. I have an account, but I couldn't open it. I think the thread was just like locked and destroyed, you know, shot into space or whatever. So like I said, the most thoroughly documented recent flop, and this is from our buddy Dennis Dyack, who stems from Silicon Knights, former developer in Canada, makers of Legacy of Kain, Eternal Darkness, some PC stuff before that, but
Metal Gear Solid, Twin Snakes.
I guess we have to talk about that, don't we? So this game, like I said, these are all like products of their time, especially this. And Two Human was announced in 1999 as a five-disc RPG full of full motion video with no loading times and a completely 3D world. This is according to Sam Kennedy's
What else do you
GameSpot,
guys want?
Write up. What's that?
It's just like, what else do you want?
Wait, did you say 1993?
1999.
Oh, 99.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, they promised the world with this game, like you said, Brett. Like they were too big for their britches even back then. They had like one console game to their credit, and that was Legacy of Kain. But as you'll see, it would take them another 6 years to make another game, and I'm sure they were supported by Nintendo in that time. But at one point, it was assumed that Two Human would release alongside Eternal Darkness on the N64. So we already see some major problems here because. Two games are switching platforms. Like, they had to be just bleeding money. And I'm sure, like, being a Canadian developer, they had a lot of government support. And I think that eventually got them in trouble later, getting money from the government, not doing anything with it. Ray seems to know a lot about this. He's pouring over court documents as we speak. There's, like, a court sketch of Dennis Dyack, like, furrowing his brow, looking like Eggman. But let's continue. So the initial plot of Two Human, I guess we can all know Two Human in its current state or its former state since all the copies were put to death. It was a cybernetic retelling of Norse mythology, which was an interesting idea.
Out.
Oh, Ray's done. Which is not quite as embarrassing as steampunk, but almost.
It could be.
It could be, depending
if
on
– If it took off, it would be.
If you put a top hat on someone.
Just glue a gear to their forehead or something. Yeah, I think so. But okay, so this was very much a Blade Runner-y type game. So the initial plot revolved around a cop in the future searching for vengeance against a cyborg who murdered his partner. So very Blade Runner-y.
So I'm noticing a recurring theme in these flops, and that is vengeance.
Vengeance, yes. All these are
vengeance count too. Everyone, keep along. Count at home.
You know what? These all might be revenge stories. So Two Human disappeared from 1999 to 2000. Nothing happened to it. And then at Space World 2000, it shows up on a sizzle reel with no details about its release. Just
Space World. I know, right? I just got chills.
I know
when you said that word.
It was assumed to be 2000, and yes, this is the Space World 2000. The infamous internet meltdown after Toon Link was revealed. Were we ever so young, gentlemen?
No, that was 2002.
Was it 2001?
This is the one with the Ganon Link.
Oh, that's the one I'm thinking of. Then the next year's was the Toon Link.
That was
right.
Yeah. Yeah. 2000 was when people were still behind. They were like, they were for it.
Yeah. It's like, you lied to us. No, it's like, no, that was a different game. You lied. But then we all got used to Link looking like a Powerpuff Girl, and it was fine. I mean, I love Toon Link. So,
it's great.
Yeah.
There's room for everything.
For the record,
it's a big planet.
I was not a Ginnit at the beginning. I
haven't really started my review of Hyrule Warriors yet. Can you actually play as Toon Link in Hyrule Warriors?
I don't think so.
No.
I don't think so.
Oh, my God. They missed such an opportunity there.
Yeah. Well, with Mario Kart, there's DLC a year after, so maybe they'll add Toon Link.
I already put my money in for May. Here we go.
Oh, my God.
God. Better be worth it. But, yeah, so... Basically, Silicon Knights kind of coasted with their relationship with Nintendo. Like, I have no idea how Dennis Dyack got this clout. I mean, I know Legacy of Kain was a good game, but he must have talked big because they released one console game and suddenly they're in Nintendo's pocket. Like, they must have – I mean, he must have promised them the world too because, like I said, like, he had nothing to show for it. He had one PlayStation game to show for it, maybe a few PC games in the past. But nothing else. But
where in Canada is Silicon Knights based?
I think Vancouver.
Well, there you go. I mean, they're right next door to Nintendo of America. So they probably were like golf buddies
Nintendo
or something.
They probably dropped by for like a cup of sugar. Like, hey, guys.
I mean, yeah, it's probably all about just like who he knew and who he shook hands with.
That could have been it. Yeah, because like all throughout writing this article, I was like, Dennis Dyack, who are you? And like, how did you get here? Like,
and it was an era when NOA was. I mean, they were building a stable of Western devs, so they've been like, hey, here's a guy, and he's talking big, and
I'm sure it looked really palatable to them because they were – at post-N64, they were like, okay, we don't want to be the kiddie people. We still want to sell Pokemon, but our consoles need to appeal to everybody. And they're still fighting that fight.
Yeah.
But
all the people for that are gone.
Oh, God. They jump ship. So we all know what happened with Silicon Knights. They released Eternal Darkness, which from what I remember was pretty good. I don't know. Have you guys – played it, Eternal Darkness?
Well, people like it as much as they like Shenmue.
Yeah. I'm not a fan.
I know it does. This anecdotal from a friend who would play, who like did all the endings and did all the different variations and was like, yeah, it's really problematic, but like genuine scares, genuine good moments in there. And it came out not far from the remake, the Resident Evil remake at the time. And like those were kind of, he was like, I can't really decide which one I was like.
Oh, wow.
But that's one person. But he's the only person I've ever heard talk about Eternal Darkness.
I've heard really good things about it. I heard it was a really good like adaptation of H.P. Lovecraft stuff. And the insanity effects were cool. Unfortunately, like every magazine was like, here's all the insanity effects. Well, like, well, thanks a lot, guys. Now it's like, why did you show this to the press?
Yeah.
Like, it should have been a surprise.
Yeah. Yeah, I had never played it because the only way you can get me interested in a horror game is to make it about alien. That's it.
Right. Cthulhu could be an alien. Based on some interpretations.
Alien with a capital
A. The alien, okay.
The xenomorph.
Get H.R. Geiger on board.
The big chap.
So they also did the Twin Snakes, which we can talk about for a minute. It was okay. It broke the game. It was a weird project, like 5 years after Metal Gear Solid's have a remake. Like, weird.
Yeah, and the new cutscenes kind of missed the point of the story and the characters.
Yeah. Brett, did you have any thoughts on just Twin Snakes real quick? I mean, from all accounts, actually, it was a successful financially remake, and it Dynastatic got to work on a Kojima game, like an American developer, or sorry, Canadian developer, touching his baby. That just seems unprecedented even now.
Yeah, it was
– he was the first Ryan Payton.
Wow.
Like everyone else, I mean, I adored MGS1 and the prospect of playing it again, but like clearer and in – maybe it was progressive scan. I can't remember. But like just this update, it was like, this is too good to pass up. But then I was like, I don't know if I'm going to buy it or not. But this game forever has this like sweetheart, like I can't say anything bad about it because it has this nostalgia factor of I went to PSM to be an intern in March of 2004.
Oh.
And it was my very first like I am in a games publication. Like, oh my God, this is happening. I'm from the Midwest. This is a dream come true. And like totally like a jersey or a guy after a football game got thrown his jersey to some kid. Somebody was like, oh yeah, I'm really good friends with Kojima. This came in. Oh, you're leaving? Here you go, kid. And I'm like.
And it was covered in sweat.
And I was like, I got a free game? What? And was like just this copy of Twin Snakes that I still have that I'm like. And then I went home and played it and was just like, man, video games. Like, this industry is amazing.
And since joining the press and leaving it, you've just been throwing out free games by the garbage bag.
Oh, God, yes.
Like, get these free games out of here. I don't want them.
Head to a Goodwill in San Francisco and it is loaded.
Yeah. Yeah, man, so, I really blew the mic there. I'm sorry.
So I played it, and after about an hour of playing it, decided that I think the better high-resolution Metal Gear experience was Metal Gear Solid for Bleemcast.
Mm. Ooh, Bleemcast. That could be another flop.
I enjoyed that a lot more than I enjoyed Twin Snakes.
I don't know. I don't want to ask how they did the controls on the Dreamcast controller. It seems complicated.
I mean, it wasn't that tough because it's not like Metal Gear Solid 1 was dual stick or anything like that.
No,
but
you used all four of the
shoulder
buttons.
Yeah, I think they... mapped it to the D-pad or something. Okay. I can't remember exactly what.
I'll take your word for it. So what happened after this little partnership with Nintendo? Well, they jump ship again. Like Dennis Dyack's like the friggin' Music Man or something, just going from town to town swindling people. And
really put Ogdenville on the map.
Yeah. Hell yeah.
You made the reference before I could.
You guys, Simpsons, we're having a Simpsons off in here. So it slipped past. Okay, so what happens at Microsoft's XO5 conference? I think it's called XO5. Essentially, they're like, here's all of our new developers for the 360. Like, here's all of our buddies. And strangely enough, that's also when they announced the Halo movie, which never happened, the Peter Jackson
Halo
movie.
They're still working on a Halo TV series, okay, so the spirit lived on.
It better be as good as the fiction in Destiny, or I ain't tuning in. That was a joke.
Man, I just saw that opening today, and I was like, okay.
It gets better. Oh, wait, no, it doesn't.
Yeah. It's not like bullying. It gets worse.
It's just like, I don't know. I don't need a reason to jump around and shoot people in a video game. Like, you could just be like, push start, pick your character, go. Like, in the ancient times. That's fine. That's fine.
So what happened? Okay, so long story short, Microsoft's like, we have two human now. We have the two humans. And it was going to be out for Holiday 06, but apparently...
Bob, it's T-O-O, not T-W-O.
Oh, damn it. Okay. I'm thinking of Two Worlds. Is that a... open world game or like a really pretty? Okay, got it. Okay.
Someone did a – this guy brought this back. Some friend at the time made their gamer tag. They bought a 360 and their gamer tag was Too Human, Too Furious. Very proud of
that. I like it. So what happens? It misses its release date. Not a big surprise. But Dyack is like, it's Unreal Engine's fault, guys. They promised a complete engine and it doesn't work the way we want it to. So we're going to sue them and tar them and feather them all through the press. And that's what happened. He got really mad at Epic through the press, so he claimed to have built his own proprietary engine for the game. That's not entirely true. We'll get to that in a second. But between the initial delay and the actual release, that's when Dyack went into like rage mode with the press. He was on podcasts. He wouldn't shut up. He became like public enemy number one for gamers. And this all culminated in something called the Owned by Dennis Dyack thread on NeoGAF, which is a gaming web forum. And essentially, he's like, hey, guys, if you don't like my game, tell me. And if it comes out and people like it, your avatar will be branded forever owned by Dennis Dyack. But I guess this got out of control. People were making fun of him. He became really incensed about the fact that he was being criticized on the internet. And it seems weird in this modern era of like female writers and developers basically being threatened away from business by, you know, jerks on the internet. He was upset about like people photoshopping him and things like that. It was a much simpler time, I think, you know, in terms of internet abuse.
Well, he absolutely brought it upon himself.
He did. He did. Yeah, I mean, not to victim blame, but he was like a millionaire game developer.
The difference between then and now was gamers punching up.
Yeah, true, true. They were punching in the right direction.
Yeah.
Towards Dennis Dyack's head. But
yeah, so like Dennis Dyack had a big problem with you know, the coverage of games, especially previews, because people weren't liking Too Human at the time. What do you know? So he got on this big jag about like how previews are basically just
And I think he told one up Mark McDonald that he shouldn't have his job or something like that. Yeah. Like really just aggressive and awful. Yes. That is not the way to sell your game that's been in the works.
Thankfully,
for 9 years.
Retronauts was one of the one up podcasts who did not incur any of that wrath.
Thank God.
Because we only talk about old stuff.
Yeah, we could have talked, we could have cast shade on Legacy of Kain, but I think we all like it.
Yeah.
I do want to read one of his quotes that he said about NeoGAF in other forums. He says, this is Dennis Dyack, probably like 2007 or so. He's like, NeoGAF and other forums like this that don't have good management and are not only hurting society and hurting the video game industry, they're in decline and they need to reform quickly before people stop listening to them. And that kind of feels like a modern okay criticism of like Reddit and 4chan today, but I think NeoGAF is not as bad as he thought it was.
It's been tidied up a lot,
I feel,
actually.
Like I said, simpler times. And yeah, like talking about the recent – I won't go into specifics, but lots of horrible things have been happening recently. I think NeoGAF has been like pro the good people for the most part. Like I don't see any stinkers on that
site. Yeah, generally. So.
Unfortunately, that sounds exactly like someone who was banned from NeoGAF.
Yeah.
For having a stick up his ass.
Yeah.
Trying to think that he's the best person in the world.
Yeah, he seemed to have just a bit of an ego. So yeah. We're going to wrap up Too Human soon. So guys, don't worry. We're going to move on. And so a little over 9 years after its announcement, Too Human is released. And everyone's just kind of like, what? Yeah. This is it?
I was on the EGM review.
Oh, you were? What'd you give it, right?
D.
Nice.
You burned that bridge.
Yeah. D for Dyack. Yeah, I played all the way through it. I also did a small guide for it because I was still at my cheats then. So I've played through most of Too Human. Yeah.
Well, Ray, I haven't played any of it. Can you talk about the quality of Too Human?
Low.
Okay.
The thing that always got me was this death sequence, because every time you die, you have to sit through a 30-second sequence of like this angel taking your character up and just bringing him to heaven, and then somehow resurrecting him, and you have to do that.
I mean, that was one whole disc of the FMV originally.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, it's like please enter disc two.
And you just sit there and go, well, is this like a punishment, or was this like intended to be there because it's supposed to be, I don't know, Dennis Dyack's cinematic vision or something? But you have to sit through it every single time. And plus the game's like, you know.
How dare you try to censor him, Ray?
Yeah, right.
I think they're really just trying to discourage you from dying. Like the incentives for not dying are really high.
Yeah, but then I think, well, you know, based on who Dennis Dyack is and everybody and all the other crap that had to have been happening at that studio at the time, it's like – maybe it was digital. Maybe they thought it was good in some way. But yeah, otherwise it's just a very brief, crappy Diablo-ish sort of game. And yeah.
I have no experience with it because it looked kind of dumb.
Thankfully, Giancarlo did the main review for EGM and then the 1UP review and then got all the crap for that.
So. Yeah, I did read that review. I liked it. Yeah. It made it seem like it was kind of a pointless,
everything
boring game.
You hear about it is true.
So this had a bad end for Silicon Knights. They would go on to make a few other games. I think that X-Men game that everyone hated.
Yeah.
Right, you probably know the name of it. You're a comic fan.
Mutant Academy.
Mutant
right?
Academy, I think
is
so.
It?
Yeah.
Was it Mutant Academy or was it Legends?
I think it was Legends.
Was it
Legends of the Fall?
That's it.
Yeah, the Brad Pitt movie. Mm-hmm. So
which one's Mutant Academy? Is that a fighting game?
Yes.
I don't know. I believe so, yeah.
Yeah, there we go.
The important thing is they made a bad X-Men game.
It was the Taras Kasi of X-Men.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So we talked about Silicon Knights getting mad at Epic for Unreal Engine. Well, Epic was like, you know what? We're going to sue you. So there was a countersuit. And Silicon Knights was found guilty of breaching their contract, misappropriating trade secrets, and infringing on Epic's copyrights. Apparently, based on court documents that I read and, like, you know, summations of the trial, Silicon Knights was using parts of the Unreal Engine in their own engine without paying for it. They're like, oh, we like how you did this lighting thing. We're just going to steal it, yoink. And then they had to basically destroy copies of all their games built with Unreal 3, including Too Human. So this game was literally, like, sacrificed, put to death.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
I'm sure if a cop walked into your house and saw a copy, they would legally be allowed to discharge their firearm into it from across the room.
Second death sequence.
Yeah. And then you will watch a 5-minute video of an angel taking it up to heaven.
One of the great defenses of Two Human was that it's great in co-op, but almost everything is, no matter how bad it is, because then you can just sit there, you know, with a friend and laugh at it. So that was always really weak to me. It's like, yeah, okay, what is not bad in co-op?
And for all the money they spent on it, and I can't find a real number on this, and I'm sure you can't find a number anywhere, but it was between 60 to 100 million, and that's like...
Yeah, which version?
I don't know. I don't know, like, if this accounts for all of development or what, but it does seem kind of like, that's not that much. But we're approaching modern-level game budgets here, modern-level AAA game budgets, so that's how much they lost. And then Silicon Knights is no more. Dennis Dyack, I don't know what happened to him. Anybody seen him begging for change downtown? I don't know.
You
know,
not lately.
Yeah.
They tried to make that re-envisioned Internal Darkness-ish game.
Oh, right. And then he made a lot of humiliating YouTube videos. It's like, let me set the record straight. And it was like an hour-long crazy vlog of him like denying things. Like, whoa.
Made a bad Kickstarter, got persecuted for it, tried to defend himself badly as he did on NeoGAF, then tried to make like a private sort of crowdfunding thing, which was also really scummy. And
The Dyack cycle begins again.
Yeah.
Let's move on to our next game, and that is Daikatana, 1999 for the PC. Probably synonymous with Chuckles, that title. I mean, like, no one takes Daikatana seriously, and I'll tell you why. John Romero, big guy, pretty hair. He's a handsome man. Got it?
Die guy.
What's that?
Die guy.
Die guy.
Because Daikatana means
he's the Daikatana guy.
Die means big.
That's true. It means big sword or big katana.
And rail means rail.
That's right. It's that simple. But who is John Romero? Jeremy, can you tell us who John Romero is, just for fun?
He's that guy who made me his bitch.
Whoa. That's true. But what did he do before that?
He was one of the lead designers on Doom, which makes him a pretty important guy in the annals of video game history.
Yeah. And Quake as well, right?
Yeah. I mean, he was with id, so he also worked on Wolfenstein. I mean, he had a lot to do. He was more kind of the aesthetics and level design. Whereas, John Carmack was more the technology. American McGee was, level design predominantly.
He was also a leprechaun, I think.
Yes, I believe so. Yeah. So anyway, he was kind of the guy behind the rock and roll album cover, heavy metal album cover aesthetic of Doom.
That's true.
And also he's like the secret final boss of Doom 2.
Yes, head on a spike or something, or like he's a face texture or something. Yeah. But John Romero starts Ion Storm. Everyone's excited because he's the Doom guy. He's like the face of Doom because he's the prettiest guy on it. So Tom Hall, who is their marketing campaigner, marketing PR guy for Ion Storm, essentially runs an article. I don't know where it ran. I think I saw it. I'm sure it ran in a lot of magazines. And it said, John Romero's about to make you his bitch.
Oh, it wasn't an article. It was an ad.
An ad, sorry. Yeah. I meant over ad.
And over again.
It was in mini magazines.
Yeah. They probably just like mass spread it everywhere. But the text was, John Romero's about to make you his bitch, in huge letters and then in smaller letters, suck it down. So like I feel like we're a lot more sensitive now. Before it was like, oh, that's in bad taste. Now it's like, this guy is going to rape your mouth. That's what this is saying. Like, this is disgusting and awful. And I think we just all rolled our eyes at the time. But now it's like, if someone wrote that ad today, there would just be pandemonium.
I never got that reading out of it. I just took it as, first person shooter trash talk. I didn't really think about the literal implications of
it. It was based on. It was just based on the stupid crap John Romero would do.
Yeah, it's like, imagine. I don't know. I guess I came from having played a lot of first-person shooters in the 90s and, following the Marathon games. Bungie was pretty open with their community, and so you'd see, a lot of their trash talk banter. It was never quite like that.
Right.
But the spirit was very similar, and they even kind of built that into, level design names and things like that.
But the thing was, even distancing its sexual assault references, it was basically like, we don't care if you know who John Romero is. He's important.
Right. Yeah.
And you're going to bow down to him because he's going to make the next big thing for you. So already, totally off on the wrong foot, right? Like, there's no way you can get off on a worse foot than that. I mean, this was the era of that sort of attitude, though.
You could like say, you like, buy this game or I'll kill your mom. Yes.
Or buy this album or we'll kill this dog, right? Right. That's yeah. National Lampoon.
I think magazine, yeah.
Okay. So basically, Daikatana, it hinges on the idea of the Rockstar developer, because here's the thing about games. No one outside of gaming cares about games unless there's money involved, which is why, like, 6 months ago, everyone wrote their PewDiePie article, because it's like, hey, you can make money off of this. And it's just like immediately everyone writes an article, PewDiePie makes $4 million a year. So that's exactly what happened with this. It's just like, hey, this regular guy made this damn video game my kids can't stop playing, and he's a millionaire now, and his hair is great. So we have to write so many stories about him and his Lamborghinis and his mansions. He's a rock star. He's dating bikini models. Like, this is like local boy makes good. Like, any, if you're a nerd, this could be your life. Like, this is an aspirational lifestyle for nerds. And that's essentially what was going on with John Romero. Like, everyone was feeding into his ego. Like, you are the next big thing. You are a rock star. And him and a lot of other, like, level designers at the time were, like, the key figures of this movement. And I think Something Awful, the website that I write for sometimes, it sort of launched off of making fun of these people,
yeah,
for the most
Cliff
part.
Yeah, Brzezinski.
Yeah, and, like, Level Lord.
Yeah,
and,
yeah. The early articles at Something Awful, back when no one knew what it was, were very centered around that kind of culture.
Yeah. And I've been talking way too much. Like, I'm not sure if I was way into PC games at the time and I knew about Daikatana. How about you guys? Were you aware of it sure. in any sort of circle?
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
Please talk about it, Brett. Like you knew it was a thing?
Mostly knew it through the ads. I mean, knew Romero, obviously, but like never played it. Saw the N64 one in a demo kiosk once and was like,
there was an N64 version. That's
yeah,
right.
Yeah. And I was like, oh, blah. And that's really, yeah. And, yeah. Then, and then the notoriety afterwards. That's really all I have.
God, N60, like you thought it was ugly before.
Oh man!
Well, let's pull this lever.
It was pretty great.
Yeah, yeah. Jeremy.
I mean, that was one of those games that was just kind of inescapable in the late '90s. Like it was just in all the magazines, all the websites. I had zero interest in it. You know, I liked some first-person shooters, but there was nothing about that one that looked interesting. The fact that they had a guy who was kind of winkingly named after Shigeru Miyamoto just felt really gross and disingenuous. Like,
which guy was that?
The main hero.
The main hero.
Okay.
Ah, okay.
Yeah, I mean, it was obviously like, I love Miyamoto games, so I'm gonna make a reference to him in my video
right.
game. Yeah, like I don't know, it just never interested me, and then the advertising didn't help, you know, endear it to me at all. But when the negativity started to roll in, once it actually came out, it just kind of, you know, confirmed that, oh yeah, I really shouldn't pay attention to this game.
Right. Ray, did you
I didn't play it, but
I never played it either, to be honest. I watched a Let's Play of it.
I didn't care about the advertising either, but I did track, you know, what was going on with it and the fact that it was delayed and delayed and delayed, and then turns out, oh yeah, it was a pile of crap.
It was this ongoing horror show in the press at the time, like, but what then, is going wrong now at Ion Storm? And a lot was going wrong.
Yeah, but then I got to read Old Man Murray take it apart.
So. Oh, that was great. That was a great review. Yeah. So what was Ion Storm? I didn't really go into that. That is the foundation of developers that was formed by John Romero, Tom Hall, and a few other people. Their motto was "Design is law," and they kind of remind me of like the Image Comics of the gaming industry, where they had the same attitude, the same lack of professionalism, the same, like, you know, I guess
same Image, trouble with release dates.
That too, yeah. Uh-huh. And I think like Image guys were the Rockstar Comics guys. They were like showing up in Levi ads and things like that. And Todd McFarlane was buying baseballs.
You invented X-Force? Yeah, me and Louise Simonson and all the other people who developed these characters over the past 2 decades. But yes, it was me.
Mm-hmm. But I don't want to call John Romero the God,
Rob,
I just forgot
Rob
his
Liefeld.
Rob Liefeld of gaming.
Liefeld, yeah.
That seems too mean. So yeah, they had like this beautiful, like I saw pictures of it, this gigantic, uber expensive penthouse office in the largest or one of the largest skyscrapers in Dallas. Like, nobody was developing games in penthouses.
I mean, after JR shot himself, like someone needed to move into that.
That'll
space.
Really lower your property values.
I remember reading some story about that where like they're on the top floor or near the top floor, and like the ceiling where they were coding or whatever was just like open to the sun or giant window or whatever, so they're all just baking in
this
heat.
Yeah,
I mean, it was ostentatious, but it actually interfered with development. It's just like, we didn't really think this over. We just wanted the best, most expensive thing. And while they were, you know, throwing money away, Warren Spector and his team was doing Deus Ex, which secretly was like as revolutionary as Daikatana wanted to be, but it was not as like, hey guys, we're here, we're gonna kick your ass and take
they're
names.
The good Iron Storm.
Yeah, they're the Glenda of the West.
Iron
of
Storm
East,
White.
I guess. Ion Storm White.
I believe the good and bad witches were north and south, and the wicked witches were east and west.
Okay, got it. Man.
It's good to keep your orientation. It's like freeways, you know, the even and odd numbers.
Okay, wow.
Good and evil, even odd. It's all based on compass points.
I didn't know that. But let's move on to what is Daikatana, guys? I didn't play it. I watched a Let's Play.
Didn't they do a video called What's Daikatana? No.
it was John Romero surrounded by like...
stacks of unsold Daikatana.
Is it a vengeance story? Help me, Miyamoto.
I don't think so. It's about finding a giant sword. It's like it's all about this giant sword.
Oh, it's really literal.
Yeah. And Ray, wasn't Quake about like... a weapon called Quake or something? Or?
Yeah, I think in much like the seed of Quake, which we discussed on the Quake episode.
That's right.
It was kind of based on like a D&D campaign from like the Romero and Carmack and stuff, like the original seed of the idea. So I think, a part of – someone's character also wielded something called the Daikatana.
I thought a Quake was a deserted Dairy Queen. Is that not what the game is about?
That's a blizzard. No. You might be thinking of the alternate version of that from like Wendy's or something.
Okay.
The Flurry. I don't know what it's called.
It's Quake in the night.
So this game was a time-traveling, globe-trotting adventure with AI companions. The AI companions didn't work very well. I mean,
there was time travel involved?
Yeah.
See, like I always got this game mixed up with Anachronox, That was another Ion Storm game, wasn't it?
I get that mixed up with Subterracore because they were just all that era.
That one, too. Like, there were all these games that were kind of opaque to me because they were on PC and I didn't play on PC.
Yeah, all the Ion Storm side projects came out before Daikatana did, which was the first like big project that they were... promising.
But this game had AI companions before like Half-Life Episode 1 made that like tenable or like made it work.
I think some of the ambitious ideas that were going to be in Quake sort of were transplanted into Daikatana because John Romero was like, oh, let's make this sort of like an RPG and let's add multiple characters and these cool weapons and stuff. But
it didn't go into Quake. More tied into RPGs than his past projects. And like it is laced with this embarrassing like white guy orientalism where all the Asian people talk like Master Splinter and they can float and have magic powers. Uh-huh. It's just the very of that era. Japanese stuff is so cool.
I married into a Vietnamese family and that stuff is totally legit.
It's just like Crouching Tiger all day, like wire foo. And...
So it's totally like
wow. Yeah.
It did reek of a lot of – do you guys know I've been to Japan?
I've seen real wall scrolls.
Do you know who Shigeru Miyamoto is?
Yeah.
Don't forget Superfly Johnson.
Don't forget about him. He's one of the side characters. Another one, it's like you have your stereotypical black character, stereotypical Asian character. I think the main guy's a white guy, so you got all your Neapolitan flavors.
Yeah.
Oh,
whatever.
Japanese guy?
I don't remember.
But I mean, you know, he was no hero protagonist.
Yes. Is that a Heroes thing?
No, that's Snow Crash.
Okay, man.
Neal Stephenson.
Sorry.
Which came out before Daikatana, so probably there was some influence there.
True. To wrap this up, because there's a lot going on with Daikatana. It was originally planned for release by Christmas 97. The turmoil that went on in this studio could fill a book. It could barely fill my article was just like, listen, guys, I can't write about all of this. So I'm just going to cut to the chase. By 99, Ion Storm had either fired or accepted the resignations of nearly half of its approximately 85 employees. Some of these guys, the core team, went on to form the Gathering of Developers, or GOD, so you could tell there was no hubris there. And based on reports at the time, Romero seemed to go MIA during all of these troubles, and who could blame him? I mean, like, all this money was riding on him. All this huge game was riding on him. He was the guy that was, you know, the spokesperson. He was out front. He was selling it to people, but it was quickly falling apart. And Daikatana eventually released in May of 2000, only 1 month before Deus Ex would make its ambition look like garbage. Like, Deus Ex is just like... This is how you can do cool things with an FPS. No one did that since, really, but it was just showing you a way this genre could go. Daikatana was just like, oh, this is just a mess.
Yeah.
I'm sure there are bright spots, but I didn't see them.
Well, the great irony is that the Game Boy Color game is better.
That's true, yeah. Not released in America, I guess.
Oh, yeah, it was.
Oh, it wasn't? I mean, it was. Weird. I thought it was just Europe and Japan.
Maybe, but I don't know. Anyway, I mean, either way, like, they licensed Daikatana to Kemco, which was even then, like, a super obscure, on their way out Japanese publisher.
Yeah, now they just make cell phone
games. And they made the N64 port and the Game Boy Color port. Or not even port, but it's like an original sort of, like, Zelda-ish game.
So, with Yu Suzuki, I think John Romero is just getting back into game development. Like he's been promising, or
no, he's been floating at the periphery for a long time. He was involved with Gauntlet around like 2005, 2006, and then he went into the mobile market. I don't actually know what he's doing now, but I mean, it's not like he ever went away. It's just he's been various degrees of irrelevant right. for the past decade.
I mean, like John Carmack, he at least would be like, I want to make a mobile game over the weekend. And then he makes like an MMO.
Was that Orcs and Elves?
Yeah, yeah, that was. Okay. That's John Carmack.
Yeah.
John Romero, like he's in the mobile space, but I think he's being more open with like, I want to be in this again. Like, I want to make a game with my name on it again. I think enough time has passed. Maybe he's right.
Have you forgiven me yet?
I do want to see him prove himself after, I mean, like Quake and Doom and stuff like
we'll
that.
We'll see.
Yeah, we'll see. Definitely.
I think we're going to see similar things happen to Notch.
Ooh.
Trouble yeah, on the horizon? I think Notch is cashing out and getting out, personally.
I think he's going to try and make something better that will also not be finished. Turn out to be better.
What about Skrull?
Skrulls? That's not him, really.
Oh,
that
I forgot.
That was just a different team.
Okay, got it. So yeah, like before I wrap up, essentially like I think we're going to see this with the next game too. Like he was used to making games on a much smaller scale, a game you could make in a garage with five smelly guys, you know, and some heavy metal albums playing in the background. He was not ready for a fully 3D world.
Yeah.
And yeah.
It's not really an environment for John Romero anymore.
No, no. But we'll see what he does next.
I think, yeah, like certain talents just have a time and a place. And I like you said, I think his approach and aesthetics and just overall mindset were really perfect for the early 90s for, you know, Doom and Quake. Like they were important and they really helped revolutionize the genre and push the medium forward. But I think maybe there is a place for, you know, John's kind of his vision, or if you want to call it that, with the kind of growing indie movement. You know, eventually the indie space is going to get more into like PS1 style games. We've yeah. kind of gone from NES to Super NES, and now we're going to go to the sort of low poly 3D games. So maybe this is his chance to shine again work with that space and that style.
No, I think you're right. I think we're going to see like throwbacks to these 2.5D shooters that were not just faking 3D and giving you motion sickness and stuff. I think that can be revisited with our knowledge now. So let's move on to our last game and perhaps the most notorious game of all time. It was a joke, but now it's just a tragedy. It's Duke Nukem Forever.
It's still a joke.
I guess it's still a joke. But like after hearing the details, you're like, that's sad. This is sad. So yeah, I mean, we all know about Duke Nukem 3D. It came out in 96, and it was like it was revelatory. I don't know. You come up with the right word for that one. But
more L's, more E's.
More L's, more E's.
Revelatory.
Yeah. I was in Catholic school, so I think of Revelations before I think of
R.L. Salvatore.
Okay. We are way off track. But we all played Duke Nukem 3D, right? I mean, at least I did, because it was this ambitious FPS that was in, like, the real world, sort of. It was an approximation of the real world. You were kind of jumping down the same corridors and stuff in Doom and Quake, and it was all very, very interesting but still sort of bland and working from, like, tile sets and texture sets. But in the very first level, you go to a movie theater, you go to an arcade, you go to like a porno store, you go to a bar. I mean, you're like going to real places in the real world. And the world offered a level of interactivity that you didn't see in games that day. Like you could play pool, for instance.
Yeah, I read the post you made about this, and it just reminded me of like sitting at a PC like before Pentiums Left Me Behind, playing Duke 3D and just like being so into Doom already. And then there was something about like sort of a wish fulfillment of like I'm in the real world and I'm messing – you could still tinker with the world. And like Doom, your reward was like I might find a secret or I might find more ammo or a soul sphere, something fantastical.
Right.
But this was like, oh, this opens a theater door, or this I can actually play – not really play pool so much, but like things were – you could touch them and it felt like
right,
I was
there. There was so much shit to push the E key on.
Yeah.
It was so versatile. I mean like even in the first level, like one of the puzzles involves opening the curtains of the movie theater and playing the movie so you can shoot at the hole in the screen and go behind it to get its reward or whatever. I mean, like, I think the most work was put into those early levels because there's so much to do in them. But like, I would replay them over and over again because it felt like I'm stomping through this world. It was sort of like the GTA appeal where it's like I'm in this real place acting out violent fantasies.
So Duke 3D was kind of like the tanker level of first-person shooters?
The tanker level?
Metal Gear Solid 2.
Maybe the first – I don't think it let people down that much. The other
– What? No, everyone loved the tanker level.
But the things following it were also good. Oh, okay. Just not as like detailed or involved.
There's also just technical things of – because – we were really into – friends and I were making a bunch of Doom levels and then like sending them back and forth and then calling each other on modems and like, oh, check out this thing. I made my house and wadded. Let's play it. And then going and playing Duke Nukem, it was like, wait, things can overlap and like sprites can exist on top of each other and you actually look up and down. And it was like it's like it looked enough like Doom to play this and be like, what have they done?
Yeah. I mean it was like not quite 3D, not at all 3D, but it was still like a huge advancement. The build engine was great. And like I would take I made levels in this game. This is the only game I've ever made levels in. And I printed out like the 80-page FAQ and I would read it in study hall and take notes and stuff. And then like none of my levels ever worked because doing anything ambitious required a lot of programming and
just hours and hours lost. And then like some of those programs were so sketchy.
Build would crash.
Make sector crash. The whole thing's gone. And it's
I
tweaked one vector once.
So when I was playing it the other day,
I was out the rest of the season.
When I was playing it the other day for research and I was just like seeing some of the effects, like that must have taken forever to figure out how to do that because I've tried to do things in build and they were terrible. But enough about Duke 3D. I just want to say that despite its salaciousness and its outright theft of movie taglines and other things, it is still a great game and I just played it on a live stream not too long ago for US Gamer. Go to our YouTube channel if you want to see that. But a sequel.
So should I actually try playing the game sometime? That was one that I completely passed by because I was into first-person shooters, but I was also quite a bit older than you at the
time. That's true, yeah.
So, like, to me, it just seemed sort of juvenile. I was like, yeah, I've touched a real boob before. I don't need this.
Now, it is quaint. The kind of, like...
Right.
The kind of male aggression powering it is very, very quaint and
adorable. Right, kind of like how Mortal Kombat at the time was like, oh my god. Yeah. Now you're like, oh, look at those little digitized sprites.
It's trying so very cute. Hard, but it's still like a 13-year-old boy, essentially, like drawing in his notebook. But
it never came off, at least what I remember, nothing came off as mean. Like, it just came off as like...
It was very silly, yeah.
I guess I misread that. Like, I kind of conflated it with Shadow Warrior at the time, seemed really, really gross.
That was pretty nice.
Yeah, it's different.
And blood as well. But yeah, so Duke 3D was super popular. It did some great things. So a sequel was inevitable. And on April 28th, 97, Duke Nukem Forever received an official announcement. They wanted to bring it out by the end of 98. And, you know, they're like, okay, 3D is a new thing. We're going to get rid of this build engine and we're going to use the Quake 2 engine. So it won't take us as long to make this game because we have an engine. We don't need to make one. But that caused some problems. They didn't get the Quake 2 engine in time. So they faked screenshots with the Quake 1 engine and gave them to PC Gamer. It's like, here's what we think our game will look like. Let people know that's what our game will look like, I guess.
That didn't stop Half-Life.
Oh, that's true. Yeah. Man, Half-Life. That was not a flop, thank God. So let's see what happened next. They eventually started using the Quake 2 engine, and it debuted at E3 1998. And in a pre-Half-Life world, this looked great. I mean, like, it was the same set-piece-driven FPS that we're kind of sick of now, but in this context where these things didn't exist. So Duke was, like, on the back of a truck shooting at things. There are all these different, like, weird, interesting levels and twists on the original. So, like, it felt like this was going to be a great game, and most people assumed it would be out, but that didn't happen. So we talked about issues with people who were making smaller games, not used to these larger 3D games. And that's what happened with Duke 3D because from the mid to the late 90s, like, computer technology was advancing crazy. Like, everyone was getting gateway computers sent to their houses in those big stupid cow boxes.
Oh, yes.
This is where that stigma comes from the PC, anti-PC community. But by that, I mean anti-PC gaming, where it's like, I get a PC, but I have to upgrade my card every year. It's like, that doesn't happen. That happened in the 90s. Like, you could probably upgrade your card every 8 months and still be behind, in that era.
How about that Alien Isolation for you there on your computer?
My computer has been running the same 3D card for 4 years and it's still kicking ass, so we'll see. See about that.
Fair enough.
But yeah, so like they were having problems keeping up and, you know, users were having problems keeping up. So they eventually switched from the Quake 2 to the Unreal Engine and work continued. And they threw out all of their old work. So again, we're seeing the problem of they're not switching platforms, but they are switching engines. So as Forever continually slipped release dates, it became the internet joke, basically. Yeah, like, yeah. Duke Nukem Forever, more like it's taking forever.
Yeah, I mean, Wired loved to give it their annual Vaporware Award. Eventually, they had to make it ineligible for their Vaporware Award.
It's like, we're not even sure if it exists enough to make fun
of. They were just like, we've flogged this game enough, so yeah. We're done.
So the game made another appearance with the Unreal Engine in 2001. So we have E3 98 and E3 2001, where the game made its two major showings. And again, it looked good. It looked great. I mean, for 2001 FPS, characters had faces. They had expressions. They could talk. They could this was post Half-Life, of course, but still they were working from, you know, I guess that sort of template where it's like, we need people in our games now. They need dialogue, things like that.
That's the thing, is that Half-Life was so amazing. It's like, now it's like, oh, crap. Well, we have to try to be more amazing
instead of just going with their original plan. They were like, we have to do better than that.
Yeah. So what happened next? Well, 3D Realms, there wasn't that much turmoil at 3D Realms because they were basically just burning through all of their own money making the game. They did not have investors. They did not have a publisher. They were going to self-publish, I guess, or maybe use GT Interactive. Mm-hmm. But I guess gathering of developers who we talked about earlier, who were the people who left Daikatana, I guess they were going to publish this game, and then they had financial difficulties. I believe one of their members died in a motorcycle accident or something like that. And Take-Two, are they still around? Take-Two?
Yeah. They do, you know, Grand Theft Auto. You've heard of it?
Take-Two is not Rockstar, or did they rebrand themselves?
They own Rockstar.
Oh, okay, got it. Weird. Okay. Yeah.
Also 2K Games.
Yeah.
Okay. That's weird. I was thinking of 2K, but I wasn't sure if I was getting it confused. Yeah. But anyways, now that they have a publisher, the pressure is on. And the company's CEO at the time, Jeff Lappin, was giving them crap for not producing the game. So I think he was well within his rights to say, you know, we paid $12 million for this game. We want you to finish it. So he brought this up during a conference call in 2003, and George Broussard responded on a Shack News message board basically talking trash to the CEO of Take-Two, like, hey, we'll do it when we're ready. You know what you're getting into. You know, what was Victor Island's famous quote?
Delays are temporary, mediocrity is forever.
Yeah, essentially he said that. And, you know, like, as far as we knew, development would continue until 2007 when a teaser leaked out in December. Like, we just thought Duke Nukem Forever was dead. So there was this teaser of Duke Nukem pumping iron, and he's like, I want to park my break in an alien something. Or as he was talking about pooping in an alien's face, I guess. I forget what the exact quote is. Again, no release date. They just want you to know that, hey, for some reason, 10 years later, we still have money and we're still doing this and we can still release things. So, yeah. Sure.
Now it looks modern again.
Yeah. And in 2008, George Broussard was like, we have internal targets, dates, and goals like every developer, but we're
not
going to
talk
them.
About them.
Exactly. The release date is still
Trust
when it's done.
Guys.
So here's what happened. Eventually, 3D Realms needed more money. So they're like, hey, Take-Two, can I have $5 million? And they're like, nope, how about we give you some up front? And then somebody finished the game, and George Broussard is like, that's it. I've been developing this game for 11 years, and you've crossed the line. Yeah. So essentially, development was called off because of, I guess you can call this a professional hissy fit if you want. I think it is. And that caused a lawsuit, as we saw with Two Human. A lawsuit did not help things. So Take-Two was like, you're not following through on what you said you would. We paid money for this game in the hopes that you would finish it within 6 years or so. But that's not going to happen. And the game was sort of canceled at that point because 3D Realms stopped working on it, even though they insisted they were still working on it. I mean, they didn't want to lose this lawsuit, which I think was settled out of court. But then a bunch of footage came out about the game that looked like it had come along pretty well, and it looked like it was an okay shooter. I mean, we didn't really know that much about Duke Nukem Forever at this point, but we were just happy to see that it was still alive. And we're almost at the end of the story, guys. So Randy Pitchford came to the rescue of Duke Nukem Forever. We all know that guy, right? 2K Games, Borderlands man. He worked on Forever briefly. He worked on a version of Duke 3D with the expansion pack or something like that.
Yes.
And he essentially was like, I believe in Duke. They said always bet on Duke, and that's what I'm going to do. And he did. He essentially got 2K to act as the publisher and buy the rights to the game. And it went from a PC release to an Xbox 360 and PS3 release. And this was all unveiled at PAX 2010. And Pritchard, what did I say? Pritchard? Is that his name? Pitchford. Sorry. Pitchford. Man, it's getting hot in here, guys. Pitchford said, you know, somebody once said always bet on Duke, so I did. I put myself right in the middle there and put all the chips on it, and it worked out. Our strategy was to get it there, to get it to where we know it's there. We know it's happening. We have it to the polishing stage where we have it running on all the platforms and we know it's ready to ship.
Yeah.
And at this point, the game just was finished and it came out. I mean, like, I guess it just needed extra time for all the time it spent.
Nah, I think it needed to be away from George Broussard.
That's true.
It was a flippin' crazy man.
And we'll talk more about him in a second. But that's the end of the Duke Nukem story. I mean, like, development, there was no, like, internal struggles. There, I mean, there was one ego at the center of it, but it was not really clashing with people on the team. And after this game was canceled, the reason Randy Pitcher was able to rescue it was because people were continuing to develop it out of their homes. Like, the development team was like, we like this game. We're going to keep working on it. So they were working on it outside of the office after there was no chance of release. Like, they were devoted to this game. Mm-hmm. But it came out, and I think we had all grown up, and Duke Nukem hadn't, because I feel like he did seem like he was trapped in another time, and the game didn't really acknowledge this. The game was like, no, face value badass. But we had been used to like so much of like post 9/11 super cynical irony that we need – if you're going to swallow that kind of a character, you need some sort of like self-awareness to him, because it's just like he's just a catchphrase-spewing monster.
The original games did have.
Yeah.
I mean, I think a character like that could work, but you know, even if it didn't take itself seriously – but it would have to be done so well. It would have to be just absolutely pitch perfect, spotless. And that wasn't that game.
I know, like, at the time, I don't want to steal their jokes, but A Giant Bomb was saying that, like, they should have, like, they should show you the, like, the patheticness of Duke Nukem. Mm-hmm. Like, after he says a catchphrase, he could be like, I got to go pick up the kids from soccer practice or something like that. Like, he's still, like, a regular guy. Like, if they would juxtapose, like, just being a middle-aged, like, loser with him being an action hero or something like that, like, something that, like, the Venture Brothers would do, I feel, with a character like that.
Was that what Matt Hazard became?
Yeah. Matt Hazard... I want to say yes, but God, it wasn't executed very well.
No, because you're parodying a parody.
It was very strange. But yeah, I mean, like, the saddest part about this story was that after all this time, Duke Nukem 3D, even if you divorce it from the kind of gross content that people rightfully complain about, and I agree with them, the game was just bland. It was not very interesting. It was just like – it felt like it belonged in 2006, which when I feel like the design document or whatever you want to call it was finalized.
Right.
I never played it. It was weird because I had been working in this industry since 2007, but I came out to SF to work at 1UP. And my first E3 was my second week of work, and Duke Nukem 3D shows up. Mm-hmm. So it was like, do I really work here? Is this like, is this a dream? Duke Nukem exists? I have a job in the gaming industry? Like, what's happening? But that's my experience, and I never played it. How about you guys?
I did play through about half of it, and the combination of it being the game that it was, and then also just very like what had been kind of a juvenile crassness that you could kind of roll your eyes at became like as the game wore on, as people have spoken to at length, it just got so not juvenile anymore and just like seemingly distasteful and
mean
and mean. Yeah. Just like outright like, I'm going to turn this off. It's also just like the combination of both of those things together was like I followed this for a good 10 years or whatever the final tally was, but I'm kind of done.
I think 13 years in that echo chamber just isolated everyone who worked on it from kind of outside perspectives, and they really needed someone to come in and just say – I mean I know they had people come in to finish the tech work on the game, but they really needed to have someone come in and say maybe you should change this script or this weird sexist level objective that's really horrible and off-putting. I think,
and it's like it's not just – but that's Duke. Like, well, it's not.
Like he can't
– there's a line.
And I think like I can't think of any – direct references, but I think the script had a lot of like super dated stuff in it, like Bush era commentary in it, because it was made like at the heart of like Bush era America, and it just didn't fly anymore. Ray, did you try this at all?
Yes.
What'd you think?
I don't know what to add. Really. I think Brett did nail it. Big disappointment because I was, I guess, ready for it in a way, because I did like Duke Nukem 3D a lot and I was waiting for it, and it was nice to see it coming back, and, you know, I was ready to give it a chance, but they kind of squandered the chance.
There were just so many, like, super serious, like, shooters. Like, the time was right for someone to just step in and be like, we're going to make fun of shooters, of action heroes, of the storytelling that's going on now. Yeah. And it's like, that's what I think was in our heads.
I might not have had a big problem with it if it were actually funny, you know?
I think, like, Painkiller and Serious Sam sort of rose to replace Duke as sort of fast-paced, like, badass simulator, I guess.
It's like if the Zucker brothers wrote FPS movie.
Starring Kelsey Grammer?
Yeah.
Weird. So yeah, that was our flops episode. Hope you enjoyed it. It's also our season premiere. So thanks for your money, and please keep giving it to us because we love you. I was going to talk about other flops. We don't have a lot of time, but I just have a few. Like Layer was a big thing. Remember that? That was like Factor Five's, Factor Five's death. They died for Layer.
Yeah, I mean, and I feel like the biggest problem with that wasn't even necessarily their fault. It was like Sony came in and said, oh, it's a launch PS3 game. You guys better make it all about six axis.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, yeah, in that case, it was not. I mean, this is not a case of inflated egos or just crazy ideas.
Yeah, in a way, the inflated ego was Ken Kutaragi. And then last minute edition motion control.
That jerk. So also Advent Rising, which was a planned trilogy, but it turns out no one wants a Mormon retelling of sci-fi stuff.
Not
I guess.
So much.
What about a Norse one?
That they still don't want that. Ooh, no. We got to keep both the religions.
Mormon Norses, Norsemen.
Norsemen.
I'd love some s'mores. Thank you.
I think they might have
the four Norsemen.
Maybe they would have bought some watchtowers if they were around. Wait, are those Jehovah's Witnesses?
That's Jehovah's Witnesses.
Okay, I'm sorry, man. I'm pissing off so many people probably right now. Radar Scope. I
disagree with this. Radar Scope. Okay, so that's Nintendo's big arcade disaster in the early 80s. That was just one of many, many, many disastrous arcade games of the early 80s, late 70s. I mean, I don't think there was hubris involved in that. It was just misreading the market and having an irrelevant product. And what's different about that game versus so many other arcade flops of the early golden arcade age was that they managed to salvage it and turn it into
It doesn't stand out, but I think it's like notable for Nintendo maybe. BioShock Infinite?
Debatable.
It did destroy an entire developer, and I don't know.
Yeah, but that happens so often now.
True. I guess it does. I guess it does. But it's just like
what's so special about that.
It did have like 6 years of development, and I guess I never see it not on sale. So I don't know. It's never not $4.99 on Steam. Like you can always get it for $5. Yeah. Brutal Legend, and I think Psychonauts too. Like. Before Tim Schafer and his crew found a better way to sell their games and a better way to make their games, their first games were huge like losses for them, and it was kind of scary for a while.
Yeah, but I thought flops was more about spiritual as opposed to financial. Like, I would say those games were pretty successful
creatively.
Speaking,
I would say
creatively.
Yeah. But I didn't.
And
worry
I don't think there was a lot of ego involved in them either.
No,
like, I don't see
Tim
Schafer as that lumberjack hipster. I don't see him as being a particularly. Cocksure jackass.
True.
He's the realest dude on earth, man.
Yeah, like, he's the cool uncle of games.
Like, we were somewhere in like SF somewhere, and we ended up like bumping into him, and it's like, yeah, I'll give you a ride. And I'm like in his back seat, like, let me move this car seat out of the way. And I'm just like, this is like the nicest man. And so, yeah, there's no like hubris involved.
Yeah. To be fair, none of these really fit the rubric I created because they're just like outliers, but they're still notable failures in some sense.
Right. Everything we've talked about has just been because of Hindenburg-sized egos that ended the same way.
And I forgot to mention, like, where's George Broussard? Like, where'd he go? I looked under the table. We're safe.
No, that's not him. That's somebody else.
Whoa, jeez. That's actually Yu Suzuki.
So, I like the game, but what about Final Fantasy 13? It fits so many of your categories. Like the idea of creating something big. It was designed as like the first part of this massive trilogy or overarching series that had no real connection within the games.
And immediately it was dialed back like, oh, wait, no, this is Type Zero. No, this is something else. Yeah. Like,
it's definitely like a hiccup that got caught.
Yeah.
Where it's like. Yeah. And I love 13 also for all the criticism I get, but it's like I still enjoyed it. But it was promised the whole Fabula Novella whatever
Crystallis
thing. Yeah. Like it did seem
which
like
had nothing to do with Crystallis for NES.
No, too bad. Yeah. That would have been better.
The SEO for that's all messed up now.
Yeah, that's actually good. I'm glad you brought that up, Jeremy, because it does fit this scope and like the egos at play and poor management.
I don't even know if ego was necessarily a problem. It was more like
I sense an ego.
It was much more at the corporate level, I think. They looked at Final Fantasy VII, which was a big hit, and then they started to do the expansions of Final Fantasy VII, the spin-offs and everything. And I think what they said was, all right, why don't we build that into this game from the very beginning? And they were still kind of hedging their bets by not making Versus 13 and Agito 13 directly tied to Final Fantasy 13. But still part of like this overarching worldview or whatever. So they were being cautious on two fronts, like taking a very conservative approach to franchise building, and at the same time, I don't know, it's just weird. But like having talked to the people behind that game quite a bit, like, to me, I never saw them as being
I don't think it's
egotistical, just more like, oh, we've always done things this way and this is how the Final Fantasy way is.
Mm, okay.
But that's more a Japanese mindset than necessarily ego. It's just like, this is the system that works. Let's keep doing it.
I just sense an ego in terms of like, you like Lightning, right? Of course you do. Of course you do.
You've always liked
Lightning. Yeah. she's Girl Cloud, right?
I don't know if it's even that so much as like Motomo Toriyama saying, I like Lightning.
Yeah, it's like, here's my wedding picture, guys. You can play through it now. He's a troubled man. Mm-hmm. Let's wrap this up. We've had a lot of fun today, and we're all sweltering in our tiny studio. So you can find us on Twitter, Facebook, SoundCloud, and Twitch.tv as Retronauts. And you can find us at our new home at US Gamer. So come on down and click on some stuff and click on our ads and just keep reloading the page over and over again, because I'm sure that'll help us, right? Right?
Some point. Yes. Okay. Also SEO.
I guess if we get some ads at some point, sure.
Yeah. And as always, please review us on the iTunes Music Store. They always help our ranking, and we want people to know about our show. We're always getting new listeners, and that's all because of you guys. So thanks so much for helping out on that end. And contact info. You can find me on Twitter as Bob Servo, and I also write for US Gamer and Something Awful regularly. So go to those sites, read my stuff, read everyone else's stuff. It's all good. Ray?
I'm on Twitter, RDBAAA, and I like video games.
Hooray. Hey, Brett, where can we find you?
Brelston on Twitter. I'm also Capcom Unity. We're posting blogs. It's on Twitter, Facebook, and all that stuff as usual. And let's see. All the associated brands. I mean, Resident Evil, Street Fighter, Mega Man, Monster Hunter, all have their own equivalents. Yeah.
And can you talk about podcasts?
Podcasts. Well, Unity, we started up our podcast again for the Capcom Unity podcast, which is headed up by Greg Moore. And he does a really good job of, we pick one topic and kind of talk through it. And he was in localization and community and all kinds of different places. So he had a lot of insight on that. And we had a really good episode about localization, including having people on, David Krislip, who's been at Capcom for like years and years.
Oh, wow. I think you meant personal podcasts, Brett.
I have those too. So there's Laser Time Network, which has Laser Time, the pop culture podcast, and then also I do VG Empire, a game music podcast, where it's also bi-weekly or quad fortnightly, or however that
whatever it shows up. I'm appreciative.
We just most recently, as of this recording, did a I forget the name of the composer.
Masafumi
Takada. Takada, who did Danganronpa, who did No More Heroes, God Hand, Killer 7, just this great body of work in the last like 10 years.
That was a great episode.
But then also just every other week we did some fun Famicom sound chip stuff, you know, episode about Ninja Turtles games and you know, all kinds of stuff. VGEmpire.com is where that usually sits.
And I think we'll be in Rocktober by the time this
annual Rocktober.
Can you leak any details, or do you have not to figure that out yet?
Depending on when this posts, I mean, it'll be active. I don't know.
Okay, sure. We'll let you figure it out. Go to VGEmpire.com.
Prior ones were Castlevania in 2012, and then 2013 was Final Fantasy. And the bit there is like a brand or series that's too big for one episode. So for 1 month, it becomes a weekly show, and we kind of like try to like tackle it.
I'm looking forward to it. And Jeremy, who are you? Where can we find you?
You can find me on Tumblr. Tumblr, Twitter.
Yeah, you can.
As GamesBite. I am at usgamer.net and also have some various and sundry little side projects. I'm most fond right now of anatomyofgames.com, but GameBoyWorld.com is pretty fun too.
Cool. Thank you so much, Brett, for joining us, and thanks for everyone else for coming in. Also, Ray, I forgot you're a guest now, so I have to thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome.
God, it burns
not
me
really
up.
Not really a guest.
What's that?
He's not really a guest.
I guess so.
No,
he's a special, I deserve the best. Special returning guest?
Yeah.
Okay. It's like, you know, a regular in the cast who still gets like the special credit at the end of the credits.
It's like in Cheers when Diane left and then starring... she would come back for the last episode.
No, I'm Heather Locklear.
Okay. Whoa, great. Okay. All right, that was weird. We'll see you guys next week, or in 2 weeks.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's right, for a new episode of Retronauts. Thanks so much for supporting us, and welcome to the new season. Later.